Welcome to this episode of Religion and American Public Life, a podcast of the Blasey Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. I am Mark Massa, and I have the happy good fortune of being the director for the Blasey Center, and I'm serving as today's host. This podcast is the newest initiative in the Blasey Center's commitment to connecting a community of scholars, policymakers, media, and religious leaders in conversation and scholarly reflection around issues at the intersection of religion and public life in the United States. Beginning this past Ash Wednesday, the parish of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in Columbus, Ohio, revealed a new art installation for the season of Lent. Abstract paintings based on the seven last words of Jesus. And today we have the opportunity to discuss this particular installation, as well as the connection between spirituality and art, with the installation's creator, Stuart Hobbs. Stuart is a native of Texas and attended Ohio State University in Columbus, where he received his PhD in American history. He wrote his dissertation, which became a book which I read, and I thought it was a very good book, actually, called The End of the American Avant-Garde, and you might want to say a few things about that later on. He currently works at Ohio State. I guess he found a happy home at the Ohio State University, where he works right now on medical research and instruction. Welcome, Stuart.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
So, Stuart, I have a bunch of questions for you. You sent me a link to the art, which is quite extraordinary, I thought. I immediately thought it was important stuff. And I guess I would like to begin by just asking you, what inspired you? You're an academic, you're a trained academic, you have a high-level research degree. What inspired you to start painting in the first place?
Well, it goes back a long time. My father actually painted landscapes. I know it's like every few years he'd bring out his easel and paint two or three paintings, and then it would go away again. But he taught my brother and I how to do that. So that was my first experience with painting when I was very young. And then I guess as I moved into adulthood, was an avid museum goer, and my parents had lots of art books, so I was always looking at those as well. And then I was doing my research on the American avant-garde, which was included composers and painters and writers, but also painters. And, looking at their paintings, people like Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko, and reading about them, it just made me want to paint myself. So, I took some classes and started doing, especially that time period, painted paper collages in a very kind of avant-garde found object way. I would get newspaper and paint that in colors and then tear the newspaper and glue it down and make different patterns and things like that.
How old were you when you began that, when you began painting yourself?
Well, at that time, I was probably, late 20s, 30s, something like that. And so I was carrying on off and on over the years doing that. And then just a few years ago, I read a book by Mary Gabriel called Ninth Street Women. And it's a collective biography of a half a dozen women who are abstract expressionist painters, like Lee Krasner and Elaine de Kooning, whose husbands were, they kind of sacrificed some of their careers to promote their husband's work. Then Grace Hartigan and Helen Frankenthaler and Joan Mitchell. And so, reading about these people, kind of the same thing has happened earlier. It made me want to start painting. So I began to paint again, had some classes over the years, and just began to paint in earnest, as it were.
We're glad you did, because your work is actually quite interesting and intriguing. Now, you know much more about this than I do, but I know that some of those abstract painters, like Mark Rothko, did work that he conceived to be directly linking art with spirituality. And of course, there's the famous Rothko Chapel in Texas that he painted. Was Rothko an especial inspiration to you? Or?
Yeah, I mean, Rothko is one of my favorites. Don't paint like him. No one can really paint like Rothko, but his paintings are incredibly moving. I'm probably more in some ways stylistically influenced by the likes of Jackson Pollock, or especially Joan Mitchell, and the kind of all over abstractionism. But all those painters did see themselves as, they saw the secular materialist world of the mid 20th century as being very stifling to the spirit. And all their work was trying to take us to look at things differently and to move in a different way and be in the world in a different way. And someone like Joan Mitchell, she always describes her work as being very much inspired by nature. more, and especially the emotional experience of being in nature.
Whose work is your own art in conversation with? So it's clearly Joan Mitchell. Who else?
I'm clearly obviously in the, you know, in the tradition of the abstract expressionist. So I was just, I know I recently finished a painting I called Blue Sun, and it has this kind of blue spherical or oval kind of shape in it, which does seem to be channeling some sort of inner Adolf Gottlieb, who is another one of the abstract expressionists. I think especially the Joan Mitchell's boldness of line and her courageous color combinations that aren't always what the color wheel might suggest you would do, those have been very influential. I have my own characteristic marks, as it were, so it's not really painted the same way. I use a lot more palette knife, for example, than Joan Mitchell does, and she's much bigger and grander than my paintings. But I think she's kind of the chief influence probably in my work right now. Although, again, that all-over style, too, of Pollock is certainly in there, not with lines and things, not the same way, but covering the canvas and juxtaposing a variety of different colors.
One of the things that most struck me, you sent me an actual physical painting, and it's quite bold and interesting color combinations, and the juxtaposition of colors is striking and actually caused me to look a long time at it, trying to figure out what's going on. So was that something you got from Mitchell or from Frankenthaler or who?
Maybe all of them. There's an abstract artist named Makoto Fujimura, and he's described his work as slow art. And that's meaning the idea that you need to just be with it and look at it. And really, that's kind of what's been behind all of my work. I do see it as being a kind of meditative work. And maybe in this way it connects with Rothko, a much more active sort of style than his. But it is intended for the viewer to look at it and observe those colors like you talk about and kind of be with the work.
That's very interesting. Slow art. That's my new phrase for today. I had never heard that before. So and it has a real evocative sense in terms of spirituality, of sort of taking time to slow down, take it in.
Exactly.
Experiencing it.
Yeah. And the idea of my art too is that you can take that same experience out into the world. I mean, in a way, there's all these, you know, there's color out in the world. You can go out and admire how the water, the sunlight dances on water. I just get rid of the middleman and focus and get rid of the trees and the water and focus on the colors themselves. But indeed, there really are an invitation to go out into the world and just look at the world around you and note the colors and shapes and what's around, to slow down and just be.
As you know, most of the history of art in the West, Christian art in the West, mm-hmm. is representational art, but you do non-representational religious art. Why did you decide to paint in that way, which is a new, I mean, certainly since the mid-20th century, there's been a stream of that, but it's not the major tradition. So what did you find appealing personally in painting non-representational religious art?
Well, let me start to answer that maybe by asking a question, which is, why did Hilma af Klimt of Sweden, Vasily Kandinsky of Russia, and Arthur Dove of the United States, all independently, but at about the same time in the late 19th, early 20th century, invent abstract or non-objective art in the Western tradition? I think the answer why that sort of convergence happened independently at that same time, well, Yogi Berra, I think, has the great philosopher, leads us in the right direction. He said, you can see a lot just by looking.
That's right. Yes.
And those three artists looked out at the world of art, and you know, they realized that with the invention of photography in the 19th century, that long tradition from the Renaissance of vanishing point realism was kind of coming under a challenge. And the Impressionists, of course, responded to that by understanding that what we see is it's what's out there, but it's also a reflection of you know, light bouncing off objects, and so they, you know, broke those patterns of light down. So it's a way of seeing things differently. And you know, in that context, I learned recently that about 8% of women have an extra, I believe it's cone, in their eyes. Remember, the rods and the cones are the cells that help us to see and process color in our eyes. So 8% of women have an extra cone. I think it's the cone, not the rod, but one of the two. That means they can see the same color spectrum that you and I see, but where you see 100 shades of green, they can see 1,000 shades of green. And I understand that there's a kind of shrimp that sees the ultraviolet spectrum, so a whole different kind of colors than we see. So again, this idea that color is, and seeing is about what's out there, but it's also how it's processed, how it's also inside us. So that raises in the question, as these other artists then saw, well, why can't we just paint what we see inside? And so that's that inner vision that is what abstract artists, and that's what kind of moves me as well then. I see all creative artifacts are like their own universe that hadn't existed before. But I think especially abstract painting, maybe I think it parallels well with music. A string quartet is something, you know, that exists in the ether, as it were, and is its own really sonic universe. And so my paintings really, and other abstract ones, are their own visual kind of universe.
Let me put that together, because what you're saying is quite interesting. If I'm gathering what you've said correctly, that you believe that non-representational religious art evokes a different set of spiritual questions or concerns, mm-hmm. or perhaps demands more of us in terms of slowing down. And
yes, that's right, because that's that next stage. That's what it's, that it invites you to slow down, to look at things. It's a more of a meditative process. And so I think it connects very much with the kind of contemplative spirituality that I practice.
In a sense, we might even say, I never thought about it in these terms before, but we might say that non-representational religious art is a more demanding spiritual discipline in terms of, at least in terms of meditation, mm-hmm. it demands more of us in terms of engaging with it.
Yes, I think that's probably true. Mm-hmm.
Now, you decided to paint for your parish church, which is St. Stephen's Church, Episcopal Church in Columbus. You decided to paint the seven last words for the wall, for an entire long wall. I've been to that church before, that the congregation can see they're sitting next to your works.
Right.
What inspired you to do that for Lent?
Well, at the most basic level, we've had this kind of art program at St. Stephen's for a couple of years now. And the west wall of the church is all windows looking on a courtyard, and the east wall is this bricks, and then there's some steel columns that rise to support the roof. They divide it into seven bays. And so I was looking at that and realized, so seven bays, seven last words. That could be a series for Lent. Now, of course, we have to ask the previous question, why did seven remind me, say, of the seven last words instead of maybe the more obvious 7 days of creation or lots of other things you might think of? And I think the answer to that is the importance of the theology of the cross for me. For example, if you look at the first painting of the series, is, you know, the first word in the from the cross was, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So that first painting on forgive, Jesus' death is not just about the events of that particular day, but Jesus is crucified every day in the evil that people perpetrate. So quickly I knew that the painting needed to address that issue of what is being forgiven, and that also it would probably need less abstract imagery. So this first painting is actually a collage that has photographic imagery on it, including scenes of child labor, the poor picking through garbage, a scene of Jews in the Holocaust, women mourning their dead sons on a battlefield, all of these kinds of atrocities that we experience in life. And in the corner, in the left, lower left corner, there's a small image of cliffs with a narrow shingle before the sea. And that's my own private iconography in a way. It's a reference, of course, to Matthew Arnold's great Victorian poem, Dover Beach. And I'm sure many of your listeners will remember those haunting last lines of the poem. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight. I first encountered that poem when I was a young man, and I recognized how apt it was a description of the human condition. And as I was trained as an historian, of course, it became only more deeply obvious how true those words were, as you probably know as well. And your listeners, they read the newspaper. I say newspaper metaphorically because there's better information in different ways, but they know what's going on in the world and what a dark place it can be. Now, I'll admit that it's not just that. As Virginia Woolf said, nothing is ever only one thing. I don't live on Dover Beach, but I do vacation there. So the question is, where's our hope to come from? And of course, the Christian message is that God is love, that at the heart of everything, at the transcendent edge of everything, there is love. And we can see that in Jesus' death on the cross. And my theology of the atonement comes from Julian of Norwich, who talked about how Jesus and God on the cross took on the suffering of all humanity and have felt the sufferings that people feel that you and I have gone through. joined us in solidarity, as it were, in that suffering.
I found that first painting to be very powerful. I guess I wanted to ask you, in the series that you did, was doing the first painting the major hump, and after that it got easier, or was painting each one a sort of different experience in terms of, you have this overall theme, of course, of suffering and God's redemptive love for us and the importance of Jesus on the cross for everyone. But did you start anew at every one of the canvases, or did you sort of know going into it, this is going to be there's a certain progression just from the trope of the seven last words, but how did you envision these things looking?
Yeah, actually, I should say my usual practice is I start with some ideas of color combination, which is not what I did here because I had these words. So these, I really started out, I did a lot of sketching, for example, and thinking about how to write some unity in the series as well as differences between canvases. So there's certain things that are like there's usually a band of very dark color at the bottom of all the canvases. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower. There's a sort of a cross motif that was adapted from Barnett Newman's Stations of the Cross that's on several of the canvases. But then I thought very deeply about how to depict the theme of each of the words in a way that would be unique to that word and also make a painting that related but was different from the others. And I did paint Forgive first, but I painted the others in different orders, in part because some of the imagery came more readily to me than others. And so I painted those. And there was one painting that I went over three times to finally get what I wanted. So, painted it once, did something else, came back again. So it was sort of an ongoing process of thinking about how to present all of this.
Now, you've spoken about painting as a spiritual practice. How do you find it to be so? Are you referring to the zone you have to be in to do it or to view it? Or how is painting itself a spiritual practice?
I guess I would respond to that in a couple of ways. One is the idea just of creation in general. Of course, we're all familiar with the first couple of chapters of Genesis where God creates the world. And then, it says God created humans, man, male and female, God created them. And the writer Dorothy L. Sayers in her book, The Mind of the Maker, observed, okay, so human beings are created in the image of God. Well, what is that image? Well, in these first couple of chapters of Genesis, the only image we've seen is God as a creator. And so I think correctly says then that obviously creativity is an important part of the image of God that we bear. Obviously, we can say that there's more to that image by looking at other texts and the scriptures, but that's still, I think, a good starting point. And so I would say that, creativity is an important part of being human, whether it's painting or poetry or doing theology. There's a whole variety of ways that one can be creative, although I think a lot of us are disconnected from that. And so I think it's very important spiritually to be connected to that creative side. And as my work is more administrative, I think it's been very important for me to develop that creative side. And then there's the other idea too of beauty. A God, of course, is ultimately mystery, but I think beauty is a way to describe God. We can say that God is love and God is beauty. And that's certainly the way that I encounter the divine. And I should say that I'm using beauty broadly. Beauty can be dark. King Lear is beautiful, but it's also very dark. So beauty doesn't just have to be a flower on a vase painted by Bonnard. And the Spanish theologian Miguel de Unamuno, he wrote, beauty is a revelation of the eternal, of the divinity of things. Beauty, he said, is the goal of hope. So I think that brings us back to the theology of the cross and the hope that comes there as well. And so I think that experience of beauty is an experience of the spiritual.
So how have you found, I'm just curious as to what the parishioners of St. Stephen's, how they've responded to this. Now, I guess the larger question I want to ask is, do you think non-representational religious art is more or less accessible than representational religious art? And do you have any practical examples of that from the parishioners of St. Stephen's who sit next to your painting Sunday after Sunday?
Well, certainly I have been gratified by a positive response that people have found them very moving. And it's interesting, different paintings speak to different people in different ways. they're displayed with the text of the Gospels, that you know, the words and little meditation that you actually, which you can read online as well. But so it is designed almost to be, you know, experience kind of stations of the cross in a way that you can go through them. And as I said, people have found that to be a very meaningful experience. I don't know if the people at St. Stephen's Parish, located on the campus of a major university, is necessarily typical of people. so I don't know how, you know, accessible abstract art might be to other people. To me, it seems like a very good way of explaining and dealing with this particular theme. I mean, just from a practical sort of dramatic point, you know, Jesus on the cross is somewhat immobile, so he's not really capable in a painting of the dramatic gesture, as it were. Would be rather, perhaps rather a static series. In fact, I've not found there's any series inspired by the Seven Last Words by any major artist, which I think is sort of interesting. And not the crucifixion scenes, but nothing kind of, but again, maybe it's harder to illustrate that whole scene. But I think the abstract approach, kind of dealing, really addressing the kind of the emotional, spiritual evocation of the words in the scene, I think was a way of actually depicting that. And so I think if anyone could take the time and approach it as we said, as slow art, to look at it and meditate on it, I think it can be moving and speak to them. That is certainly the intent.
So you would say that it is maybe, if not more accessible in a different way. It's a more demanding way of taking in, of interacting with religious art. Would you agree with that?
I think so, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just because we're not as used to it. I mean, it's interesting that it was over 100 years ago that non-objective abstract painting was invented in the Western world, the modern Western world. But it's still, most painters don't do abstraction. Or at least, I mean, again, I make the distinction between abstract and non-objective. The non-objective really has, you know, is painting that is truly a universe created by the artist. I mean, so much painting then today is actually in the continuum from, you know, photorealism to abstraction has a lot more abstract in it than photorealist. But I'm much more obviously on the abstract, totally non-objective end of things. So it's not what people necessarily always think of or think they enjoy in art or what they expect in art. But, and I think also talking with people, sometimes they're intimidated by it. I think there's some sort of a secret code. I mean, there really isn't a secret code in my painting. It really is about colors and form and the interaction between different colors and brush strokes. It's all kind of right there just to look at and to take in and to experience.
How has your own religious background, and including your religious reading, impacted the art that you create?
Well, most of my stuff, you know, isn't explicitly religious. But it does reflect, as I think, you know, my understanding, as I've talked about beauty and creativity, contemplative practice. I think all of that is in there.
So you talk about contemplative practice in painting. Do you have to be in a certain specific kind of mindset or mood to do these things? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you started a painting and you look at it and you think, no, that's not quite it. I'll come back to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, so is it because the colors... Does the color combination not working, or is the whole gestalt of the painting not expressing what it is you want to sort of do on a canvas? Or
yeah, it can be, like, for example, the painting on I Thirst. That was the hardest one to do. I had this idea of kind of doing a Helen Frankenthaler sort of style of soaking the canvas with some red paint and like the red wine and also some blue for water. And I did it sort of in a big circular pattern. And then as I started to paint around, I thought, you know, this looks like an RAF emblem. And so I guess eventually that's all I could see. So I had to paint over it. And I used that canvas for something else altogether. Eventually that whole staining technique just didn't work. I couldn't get, it was too globular. It wasn't working at all. Then I finally, the final canvas has this kind of image of a river. And that's sort of the water. It's the river that flows by the throne of God and shall we gather by the river. That worked out to be satisfactory. But I typically, but all these paintings and other paintings too, I start out with some color ideas usually and put various layers of color and usually bigger patches and smaller. Then I look at a painting, and it's not quite there yet. And I'll add a little bit more color. Typically, I know I finished it when I stand back, I look at it and I begin to smile, to laugh, to feel great joy. And I think, yes, then that it's complete.
So as you know, Stuart, since you're a historian of American history, one of my cultural icons was the great 18th century preacher Jonathan Edwards. And for Edwards, beauty was a central theological component of the holy. for Edwards, what is most unique about God is God's beauty. And he was the first, and still to some extent, is the most interesting theologian of theology as an enterprise focused on beauty, beauty in the world, beauty in human beings, beauty in art, although he himself, of course, being a good Puritan, was not that interested in art. So if you could talk a little bit maybe about how you see beauty as something that our world is lacking right now, especially the fractious nature of our culture and our politics, and what beauty might contribute, the beauty that your paintings sort of embody and invoke from us, how might that address where we are as a culture right now?
Well, you know, I think concerns like of climate change or gaps between the rich and the poor, there's obviously a lot of problems in our world. You know, I mean, we're still on Dover Beach, as it were. I think it's easy to open up a history book or the newspaper and make a good case that the world would be a better place if the trees were in charge and we weren't here at all. But then you look out there and you see that, just to pick some random examples, the beautiful paintings that Mark Rothko made, or the beautiful poetry created by W.S. Merwin, or the music of the Dave Brubeck Quartet. And you see the great beauty that human beings are capable of doing these things. So that gives you hope in humanity. There's something in us that maybe, you know, is better than the worst of ourselves that we always encounter. And people are, of course, capable occasionally of acts of great love, which is very inspiring. And so I think that's why we need beauty in our lives, to understand that we as human beings are capable of beauty. This comes from us. There's something, therefore, you know, that's beautiful in us. And that's that reflection of the ultimate beauty that's at the heart of the universe, that is God. I think we need beauty to understand that. And that's a reason why then it's worth trying to save the human community and the human family, and hopefully find a way to live better in our world and within and on our world.
I saw your paintings and immediately contacted you and said, Stuart, I want to interview you about these things. If people go online and see and want to find more about you, the artist, or them, how could they best do that?
Well, I think there's going to be a link to my Columbus Makes Art webpage on this podcast webpage, and there's even the button there for contact the artist. They can click, and there'll be also a link to the Seven Last Words series, the images, the paintings, and text about them. So I urge them to look on your webpage or the podcast page and find those links.
That'd be great. Yeah, we will certainly include those. My advice to people is go to the link and see. I think you'll be quite extraordinarily surprised by the vibrancy and immediacy of these paintings and the way that they draw you in. It'll be worth a long trip into slow art to sort of experience these things. Thank you, Stuart. It was great speaking to you.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Religion and American Life, a podcast by the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. For more information on the work of the Boisy Center, the Center's schedule of events, or to listen to other episodes of this podcast, please visit our website at bc.edu/Boisy.